Listeners, welcome to the Lost in Postulation podcast. I'm Nicola Volpi, and I have a very special guest today. Growing up on the Emerald Isle, they told him he couldn't put on a pair of boots, skis, and go down a mountain. There was no such thing. They told him he was too uncoordinated to put one foot in front of the other and run a race. They told him he couldn't fly. They tried to clip his wings, but he defied them all. And joining me for the 51st time on Lost in Postulation, it's Neil Fitzpatrick.
Thank you so much for that absolute incredible intro. I literally couldn't have put it better myself. And if anything, you have helped me synthesize what was only a kernel of a reflection on that entire month or so that we've been away. And now I really feel like a better man. Thank you for that.
Well, a better man, and you've been a busy man. Your accomplishments as a multi-sport athlete have been making the rounds globally.
You could say. My Strava followership has jumped an entire 25%. So I've gone from 4 to 5 followers now. So things are really kicking off. I'm not quite at Russ Cook level. I haven't run the entire length of Africa just yet. But things are definitely looking up on the elite sportsman venture that I'm obviously well underway in.
And I think for starters, you know, filling in the listeners, those that have not been part of that 25% uptick in your Strava, Neil completed his first ever half marathon 2 weeks ago, and someone that beforehand wasn't very keen on running, and now he's just transforming the game and himself.
If I'm nothing if not the classic early 30s reinvented guy who is now suddenly really into running for no reason. This all came about in the last 6 months or so, and what started as a recreational 5K with some colleagues, it's like an event here in Copenhagen, has turned into a personality trait. Basically where I never stop talking about it. Classic, like, and it seems to be a bit of an epidemic right now. I predict that if we trace the curve of this trend, I will be talking about ultramarathons or at least triathlons in the next year to 2 years. That seems to be just the way it goes. Maybe not. Maybe I'll fall off the wagon and just go back to being super lazy. We both are possible, but as it seems right now, that is the trend, I have to say.
There's no turning back. I can tell you that as someone who's been running a lot of kilometers for quite many years at the moment, it just gets you. It gets into the veins.
The constant striving for better seems to be the thing. I'm all about these, like, you know, when can I get a PB? Could I maybe get a PB this weekend? You know, like faster 5K, faster 10K or whatever. And then doing your first half at the time, even at the time of doing it, especially the second 10K, I was hating it. I was like, this is no fun at all. I'm absolutely regretting doing this. And then the minute it's over, you're like, that was so good. I can't wait to do another one. Which one am I doing next? You know, like, there's some weird, like, trauma bonding, psychology going on. But I enjoyed it.
Definitely. And you will see once you do it that actually also extends to the marathon, where actually you feel like you're dying towards the end of that first marathon. The euphoria, the moment you cross that line and know what you did, even though you can barely walk.
Yeah.
Incredible.
I think what's amazing to me is right now, my opinion towards marathons is absolutely hell no. Keep them away from me. I have no interest, right? And I don't know if that's that common or when someone does their first half, but honestly, like, maybe it was, I took a kind of relaxed approach to the training to the half. I didn't go all in. It was 3 days a week, whatever. So I probably didn't train myself to the point of readiness to do like 30 or 40K. But then again, I just think my reflection still is probably maybe not a marathon, maybe not anytime soon. Although, let's see, because I'm going to train up now towards the Copenhagen half in September. And if that goes well, then maybe it's marathon time in 2025. That could be an early spoiler there.
I'd love to see it. It's your mentality is the right one, though, because the biggest mistake people make is they do a half marathon or even they do 10 half marathons and they are, you know, weekly 3-4 times a week runner and they don't respect the distance of the marathon. So what they say is, okay, I'm just going to up, you know, my training and then I expect to have my time be a multiple of 2 that I get on the half marathon.
Ridiculous. Yeah.
I've seen that movie so many times. And what you don't take into account is that second half marathon that you're running there is on legs that have already run half a marathon at speed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not to mention that there is a whole mental impact of, you know, people call it the wall or whatever. First off, not knowing when it's going to hit you. Second off, the point where physically your legs are telling you no more, but you need to find a way to keep going. Whereas with the half marathon, and that's why a lot of people love it, you can really push yourself to do it fast because in a way, soon it's over if you're trained well enough.
Exactly.
With the marathon, the soon it's over, until you're at like kilometer 39, you can't even think about soon it's over.
Exactly. I can't even imagine what the journey is for a marathon runner, to be honest. Like, despite me feeling like I'm somewhat experienced now, having done enough training, I did a 16-week training run into this, still, I guess I'm only kind of scratching the surface of what's out there. But I had a question for you on this, actually. I ended up doing a very hilly half marathon. A particularly torturous route, I have to say, where you do all the hills, you think you've done all the hills in the first 10K when you compare it to the actual elevation of the thing. So when you hit the top of the 10K, you're like, okay, great, it's all downhill from here. But then what follows is a series of like U-shaped downs, basically, is where you're basically hitting hill after hill after hill upwards again on the way back to Wicklow. And it was pretty horrible, but it made me realize that like the phrase half marathon is almost a misnomer, that like there should be different classes of half marathons, I feel, because I was training in Copenhagen, Denmark, the flattest place in the world, other than like Kansas or whatever. But like it is so flat here. It's very hard to get the hill training in that you would need, right? And to say I ran a half marathon, I feel doesn't do justice to what I did. Because like I did it in 2 hours, right? I wasn't happy enough for that. But like I'm very sure that were it a flat course, that time would be very, very different, I think. So how do you feel about my proposal that we scrap the term half marathon altogether? We delete it from the vocabulary we instead come up with like a word for what that was that I did. And then if you run 21 kilometers on flat, there should be a different word for what that is. You know what I mean?
Right, right. And there should be, because one is all about speed, whereas the other one, the one you did there, you have to take other things into account if you are going to have a race strategy, right?
Mm.
I look at it also, I'm training here at the moment right now in Tuscany, right? On the hills here.
Mm.
And I know that if I go out and do a 10K here, in terms of the aerobic, because there's so many hills and some of them are incredibly steep, it's going to be a better training than when I do my 15Ks at speed in Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I get a lot of anaerobic in it, because to go up some of those steep hills, you're really like, you're pushing, you feel it in your triceps even sometimes. So I totally agree with you, a new term for that. And when you look at like the major marathons, like on that level, you're talking the Bostons, Berlins, etc., nobody in the running community would ever compare a speed in Boston, which is incredibly hilly, to Berlin, which is the flattest two straight lines, basically. So I think exactly we need to have maybe three levels of where one is flat and three is, you know, as steep as such a long distance race can get without going into trail ultra running sphere.
Exactly. I just feel like I got a bad end of the deal here by saying, yes, I did a half marathon, because that doesn't capture how hard it was. Like, that only says how long it was, and it doesn't say anything about the hills. So what I would like to say is, like, I did a HM3, right, you know? Or, like there should be, like, a difficulty class here. That's what I'm going to campaign for. I'm going to spend a lot of my time and money making sure that happens, just because I feel slighted by this occurrence.
I agree. I respect it. You have my respect. You have my support and that of my super PAC in this campaign.
Phenomenal. And as we all know, super PACs are a great, democratically sound institution that should not go away and is definitely not a terrible thing for democracy.
And is definitely clean, right?
Well, it's definitely clean. I mean, how else? It's got super right there. It means it's good.
Right, right. Exactly. I mean, you know, legalized corruption is called lobbying, right? So
we love that.
It's allowed.
We love lobbying. It's not corrupt if you call it something else. That's the cool thing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It's not corrupt if it's allowed.
Neil, exactly.
The other big sporting achievement you've had is the other week you returned to the slopes for the first time in 7 years. For the first time since we were on the slopes together. And, you know,
indeed.
I was a bit gutted that I couldn't be there with you on this great return. So maybe fill me and the listeners in on how this comeback went.
You would have been so proud to see me out there. Like, and I feel bad too that you didn't get to, because your last glimpse of me skiing was essentially a giraffe like a giraffe tumbling down a mountain, basically. Like that's the legs everywhere, arms all over, poles flying, you know, like you didn't see how good I was or how good I've gotten. Now, obviously, maybe I'm exaggerating
slightly
here. Without
any training in between. That's the craziest part.
Just, something clicked, basically. Like, I watched a lot of YouTube in the run-up here where I was like, okay, I really want to nail it this time. And it's my fourth time going, so I'm like, okay, I'm running out of excuses now to not be good. Like, I'm putting in the time. I need to actually improve here. But a few things did click this time with regard to turn structure, I would say, like hitting perfect semicircles when I'm carving and like these kind of things where previously I would have been like, don't fall as the top priority. Whereas now it was like, let's hit this perfect semicircle again. And, you know, like focusing on the right stuff, I think, and just enjoying the hell out of it as a result. Coming to something steep and instead of feeling fear, just adjusting technique and saying, okay, I know how I'm going to do this. Like, honestly, so much fun. Skiing, like the enjoyment is the perfect example of exponential returns where it's like the initial time you go, you're like, take it or leave it. Second time you go, you're like, okay, I see why people do it. And it just gets better and better. So literally, on the way home, I was like, when are we going again? Like I would have been good to go again straight away.
Incredible.
Absolutely loved it. I had one little postulation about skiing I wanted to hear your thoughts on as well. Is skiing the most arrogant, and I don't mean this from an income point of view, which that's a whole separate debate about who goes skiing, right? But I just mean...
the super pecs.
Exactly. Is skiing the most arrogant flaunting of mankind's mastery over nature in the form of a sport? Because, and I had this reflection sitting on a ski lift as going up into the like top of this mountain, and I was like, if I was left here with no ski, I would probably die. Like, but if you took all my phone and everything and didn't tell me which way was which, and it was like a bit cloudy and I didn't have the skis, I would die. So it feels almost arrogant for me to put myself in a near-death situation and then go, no big deal, guys. I'm going to make my way out of here. And sorry for this very long intro for the postulation, but it has a part B, which is very important. Putting a ski resort on a mountain is the most ridiculously arrogant thing that a human can do. It's basically like, not only am I going to live here, I'm going to go live here. That's the first thing I'm going to do. I'm going to make it fully plumbed, full electricity, running water. I'm going to have ski in, ski out accommodation. There's going to be restaurants. There's going to be, octopus and like shellfish available in these restaurants. It's arrogant. It's actually hubristic, I think is the word. Like, tempting fate a little bit, that humans are like, don't worry, nature, we got you covered. What do you think of this reflection?
I've never heard it phrased that way, and I think it hits the nail on the head. It's very much this logic of, we're doing this because we can, nature.
Exactly.
Because we own you. And I think the arrogance, there's even a backhanded slap where, especially in recent years, and that'll be even more so in those to come, due to the planet heating up and climate change, we've said, hey, nature, we don't even need snow to come out of the sky. Yeah. We'll make our own and ski on fake snow, even though the sides of the pistes are fully green.
It's insulting, really, isn't it? It's like, I love it, because a skier kind of by definition says, I love getting out of nature and sliding around on what nature provides to me. And then when nature says, well, no, actually, I don't have that for you anymore, the human is like, oh, no worries. I'm going to just make it now. So, you know, don't even need you. It's just like, it is gobsmacking, really. And if I was nature, if nature was a person and it was me, I would be very offended by skiing. I'd be like, you absolute, who do you think you are showing up here and like putting yourself where you don't belong, you know?
Nature.
It's the only sport I can think of that is a middle finger to nature, I think.
Absolutely. And I think my barber, actually, he often goes on a rant about the prototype that he calls the ski prick, of which I've been part of, right? It's the ones that sit in his chair complaining that, you know, there's not enough snow on the slopes that year. And he says, yes, because you have been flying for weekends to go skiing for the past 20 years.
The irony.
Yeah, exactly. Simplistic logic, but it's kind of a true self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't
100%.
It?
I think we need to all take the hit on this. Like, if skiing becomes less possible and more expensive because of climate change, I think we all need to be like, well, okay, we all had a role to play in this. Obviously, it would have been great if governments and like big actors, large companies, like it had also played more of a role. But like we've all partied, like we've all flaunted a little bit our arrogance here when it comes to how we treat nature. I think that's a very fair point, actually.
And there's a lot of postulations to be had on what a lot of these ski resorts, which maybe aren't at the highest points of the mountains, will end up doing in 20 years when not just do they not get enough snow, but it's not cold enough to even make the fake snow. Because, you know, a lot of these ones, we've discussed it, I think, on an episode about a year ago, where you can go to a lot of these resorts in the summers and mountain bike and still take the lifts up and all of this stuff.
Exactly.
What will they be doing at that awkward interval in a winter which is no longer cold enough to ski, but still a bit too cold to go do your normal summer hikes?
Some of them are doomed, I think, is the long story short, where like those things, you might think they make a load of money, but I think a lot of them are really scraping by even now, even in a busy season. Like those things are not cheap to run. So I think that's the sad reality for a lot of them. And then some of them are already diversifying. Like the one I was in, La Plagne, there was one of the towns you could ski to where they had an escape room as like a thing, as a business running.
Perfect
there.
Perfect for you. Why'd you even go skiing? I'd expect you to just be in and out of that escape room.
I was tempted, actually, I have to say. But no, there was enough skiing to do that I didn't do it. But like, these are the kind of solutions that they're having to bring now, where it's just like, okay, let's really, really think, what is it people do in their spare time that we can offer? And as an escape room is a good example. You only need a room and you're good to go. But I think they either need to adapt or die now. It's a critical inflection point.
It definitely is. I'm still amazed by the fact that you've totally defied the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours logic by taking a break for 7 years and then all of a sudden having improved.
Coming back stronger. I think I needed that break, though, because I was a bit traumatized after the last one. Like, I ended up on a black slope by my own... we've covered this previously. I was on a black slope, shouldn't have been there, and paid the ultimate price. But yeah, after 7 years of a gap, you really start to forget all the bad stuff and just remember how fun it is. And it was very, very fun this time.
Well, that's very good. And you got to bring your better half along with you this time.
First time skiing. Let me tell you, though, you got to be really careful bringing someone skiing. It is actually like, I didn't do enough strategy planning. So even little things like our accommodation was ski in, ski out, right? But that's only good if you can ski, because if you can't, you need to get to a green slope, right? Like for the person to learn to ski. And that happened to be like a 25-minute walk, right? From our accommodation. And that's with the boots, with the skis, blah, 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 blah. So this person, like, unfortunately, Yura's first experience of skiing was a 25-minute walk lugging the gear, being like, this is no fun, like, at all. Why am I doing this?
Why are we here?
Yeah, I don't blame her as well. It was pretty rough. Once you can ski, it's great, because you ski out of it, you ski out your door and down the it's like amazing. But yeah, getting to that point is super annoying. And I think the other thing is, I didn't do the due diligence on, does this particular resort have enough green slopes to sustain a beginner, you know? So and it probably didn't, so that made it probably less enjoyable for her than it could have been. But yeah, I think I have some credit now for a second trip. Like, I think I have just enough enjoyment from this time from her that we can go one more time. And if we go one more time, I'm going to do all the research about, we're going to get a place that's next to the beginner slope, and it's like this and that and that, and you know, we'll sort it out.
Good man. I love it. Just spreading the joy of skiing while we still can.
Exactly. This is going to be the type of thing, this podcast will be laid back as like a documentary in 200 years, where they're like, listen to what they used to do. They used to slide down mountains with snow on them. Let's do it while you can, people, is what I'm going to say. It is not going to be around forever.
Do it while you can. It won't be around forever. We just might be around forever. And listeners, you can reach out to us at lostinpostulation@gmail.com. That's our email address. You can follow us on Instagram, Neil. That's a Lost in Postulation on Instagram. And then we have a little account on a platform called X.
I'm not going to say anything about it.
Okay. I'm not going to say anything about it either. After the break, listeners, we're going to dive into a special mundane that Neil has cooked up for you guys.
Listeners, welcome back and good evening, good night. Get ready to sleep, get your PJs on, get into that bed and snuggle up. Hopefully it's a nice bed. I certainly will be upgrading very soon because we're about to talk about bed buying. That's right, bed buying, not sleeping. That, although we could actually do probably many episodes on sleep and all of its amazing, interesting qualities. We're talking specifically about the process of buying a bed. Now, it's going to be very linked to a recent example. I was the fortunate purchaser of a bed. I say fortunate, although we haven't received a bed yet. Let's see if it's good. But right. I have bought a bed very recently. So what we thought we might do is talk a little bit about this unique experience that really only comes around like once in a decade, really, if you play your cards right. And we're going to get into it. I think there's something to be learned here from your expert opinion, Nicola, on this, that like we approached it a certain way, and it's debatable if that was the right way to do it. Buying a bed is a bit of a minefield, as I've learned. There are many, many traps along the way. So if nothing else, this could serve as a handy guide for any listener who's considering venturing into the treacherous world of bed buying.
And you will at some point, listeners, because it's just a matter of time before you're going to need a new bed or upgrade or bigger size or whatever it may be.
Well, let's start with that. What is the trigger point for a new bed? It's rare, I think, that your bed collapses spontaneously and you're like, damn, I need a new bed.
That's happened to me, though.
It has happened. I mean, let's not rule it out. But most beds, I think, gradually lose, each night they lose 0.000 something percent of their goodness. And then one day you kind of wake up and realize, I'm worth more than this. You know?
Yeah. So
I can do better.
For us, our trigger, we bought a bed when we moved apartments last June. And the trigger was, hey, now we have a bigger bedroom. We can afford to have a much bigger and more comfortable bed. Before that, we were sleeping in a bed that in reality was probably meant for a person and a half rather than two. And you had to really watch out for your limbs when you were turning around in the evening. It just wasn't fun, especially for someone like me that moves around a lot during his sleep.
100%. I would like to extend actually my official condolences to any couple whose bed is 140 centimeters across.
Yeah.
Because personally, that is in breach of the Geneva Convention. Like, that is a human rights abuse.
It should be.
And it should be outlawed, honestly. So I really sympathize if anyone does have that terrible problem.
And we rolled with that, I think, for almost 3 years, probably. And I complained so much. Also, the mattress, Maria likes her mattress a bit softer than I like mine. I don't really like to sink in it because I like to turn and, you know, get moving, etc. So also having just one mattress on it in the base layers didn't help us. So for us, it was, wow, finally we get to buy a bed. And it's just been incredible ever since. Baby notwithstanding, the nights have been a lot better because of that new bed.
Absolutely. It's such a great investment, right? They say you should always overinvest in anything that separates you from the ground, i.e. shoes, couches.
Do they say that?
Wheels
of
a car.
I've never heard that, but it sounds right.
It's a nice rule of thumb. It's like anything that separates you from the ground, you should spend a bit more on, because that's where the damage can really get done. Like if you have bad shoes, or if you have a bad chair that you work in every day, or a bad bed that you sleep in, over time, your back can really start to suffer, right? So that's a bit the logic. That was the logic I applied going in. And we said, okay, we've had this bed that I bought from IKEA in 2018 for whatever was the cheapest bed that I could find in IKEA, basically.
That's always a great place to start, right? I'm going to go get the cheapest thing in the entire store.
Yeah. But classic me, this was like a short-term purchase that turned into a long-term purchase, because I had moved into a room in a flat share kind of situation, and like, you know, a roommate's thing, where I got an empty room and I was like, I need a bed in this room physically. Like it was simply that. If anyone had told me, you're going to be using this bed, by the way, for the next 8 years, I'd be like, oh, sorry. Yeah, definitely not going to get that one. It's just how it worked out. A bit like coming to Copenhagen for 1 year and it now has turned into 8 years also. But anyway, separate point. But we went out and went into the market to see what was out there. We decided we're doing it. This is our big purchase of Q1 or Q2, I guess. So we said, let's do it. So set the budget, went to the shop, talked to the guy. Bed salesmen are an interesting breed, I would say, of people. We found two types out there, pretty much. The first, and okay. I don't know if you watch The Simpsons much. Have you watched The Simpsons? Yeah.
Enough.
You know Gil, yeah. Like it's a used car salesman. Like, oh, Gil's gotta make that sale. You do get a bit of that. So these are like the 40 to 50 year olds who maybe have been in the bed game for quite a while, but like, you know,
okay.
aren't exactly smashing their KPIs, I suspect, you know, and they're not in for the hard sell. Like they seem to have like an aversion to a hard sell. So they're like, yeah, no problem. Whatever you guys want. So we had one of those.
Do you think they're a demotion relative to the car salesman?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think the car salesman...
Used car salesman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. But I think the used car salesman like does a bit better for themselves, I feel, on average. Like the commissions are better. Like they can probably add a lot more features and bells and whistles and everything.
Right.
I don't know if I would love the world of bed sales, to be honest with you. But I'm someone who, I mean, I'm trained in negotiation. I've been in many negotiations in my job. So I approached it kind of like that as well. And even then I was a bit disappointed by like, there wasn't much to do in this one. Like it was very...
It's a bed.
No, but like these beds are made up prices, by the way. That's the other thing we have to get onto. Every bed price in every bed shop is made up. Not a real price. They put a number on it. Let's say a 5-digit number. And then they slap a 50% off sticker on it and they go, wow, look at that. So it was 35,000 and now it's only 17,000. And you're like, am I honestly supposed to believe that you are giving me half price on a bed that who like is nonsense? But I made peace with that. I was just like, okay, that's how it's going to be. It's a scammy industry where they just like double the price of everything and then tell you it's 50% off. Let's just roll with that. We visited a good few shops. We kind of figured out what the going rate was. And we ended up, I'm going to give a shout out to them. We ended up going with Dreamland in Danish. Had a great experience with Dreamland, the two branches we went to. We were very happy. And of course, we played them off against each other. Not directly, but we got a good price from the first one after a lot of kind of hemming and hawing and a bit of haggling or whatever. And then said, yeah, we need some time. We'll come back another day. And then another day, we went to a different Dreamland just to see and didn't tell them anything and just saw like, okay, were we like miles off the mark or is this the ballpark that we can expect? So that was a little A-B strategy to try and extract a good number. And we did. We ended up getting the second place lower than the first. So that seems to have worked out pretty well.
Wow.
That said, right, we probably didn't do enough anchoring on like our budget being very... tight. Like I think what we should have done is been like, oh yeah, like we really can't go above blah blah blah, and like when we eventually did go above blah blah blah, we should have actually walked out of the shop. I think that was my
out of the negotiation.
You're a big fan of a walkout, I know, so you would have been out of there.
Got in trouble for it before as well. Yeah, it's not always the best strategy, but you know, I think for bed buying you could end up
yeah.
It could turn out quite good.
Because they're very eager to close in the end. And sorry, when I said there's two types of bed salesmen, Gil was the first one from The Simpsons. And the other one is like the CBS graduate, the business school graduate kind of style Danish guy who's like very slick and like, hey guys, just say if you need anything. You know, like this very like practice.
But still selling beds.
Practiced slick salesman is probably going to move on to real estate in the next 6 months. You know, like is just honing his sales skills before he moves on, I guess. So the second place, we got a bit of a slicker package from that guy. But still, both work fine. Both have their pros and cons. And we got a bed in the end, so I guess it all worked out.
Well, there you go. You put a lot of time, energy, effort, thinking into buying this bed. To each their own. I would not have had the patience for that process. So we were buying a bunch of other things from IKEA online, and we went based on the type of things we knew we wanted in a bed on the site, ordered that.
Mm.
It came in, we got it, sleeping fine. Didn't have to deal with this slimy salesman either.
That was the other approach we could have gone with. I think what we wanted was a bit of consultation, though, you know, like what should we get and what's out there and blah, blah, blah. Right. So that we did get. And then we do have, I guess, some particularities when it comes to what, you know, sleeping needs or whatever and comfort levels and blah, blah, blah. So I think that also informed the decision to go a little higher on the budget and, you know, what we get, etc. But time will tell because it hasn't arrived yet. And this is the final point I wanted to let you guys all know. Like with buying furniture from Ilvar, one of those places in Denmark, they're like, I'm going to sell you this table or bed in this case. And you go, cool, here's the money. And they're like, cool. When do you want it? And you're like, now, we just did a transaction. I want it now, obviously. I just bought it now. And they're like, oh, no. I'm going to give it to you in like way later. Is that okay? And you're like, what? How is this okay? Like, why are we okay with this? It's a bit like tipping in general. Why are we all like accepting that tipping exists? Why do we accept that a furniture company is like, yo, you're going to pay me and then I'm going to not do what you paid me for a few months. Now, we didn't pay full price, just to be clear. We put some money down and we'll pay the rest when it comes.
Okay.
Yeah, but still, we shouldn't have to pay
anything.
It's
still bullshit. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, maybe there's something about, okay, we're going to put your particular fabric choice on it, whatever. But like, can we sort this out that I can get it now or tomorrow or the next day? Why is it like 6 weeks of waiting for a bed that they are selling me? You're the guy selling the bed. Like,
and you also know this isn't necessarily tailor-made stuff. They should have an inventory with plenty of, you know, mattresses and bed pieces. Like, I don't understand. It's their job. What is in their warehouse if it's not that? Is this a money laundering operation? Do they have other things in that warehouse?
This is the key point of it, right? You guys chose to sell beds, you know? Like, nobody was like, hey, bad news, you're a bed salesman now. And they're like, oh, damn, we have to figure out the lead times and stuff. Like, this is literally dreamland. Like, and I don't want to be mean to dreamland. I think they all do this. But like, you have chosen this path. This was a vocation that you answered, a calling that you answered, you know? And then they're just like, yeah, I can't figure that out. Don't know how to get it to you sooner than 6 weeks. And like, okay, maybe it's just not something people care about usually, but I have had none of the joy of my new bed. And it's like a month and a half ago nearly since we ordered it. So I'm a bit peeved about that. And that also means that if it's not good, the saga continues and we have to like go send it back or get it changed or whatever. So yeah, it's been a bit longer than I would have liked. I would have loved to just...
That would suck if you had to send it back. Were you able to lie down on it in the store? How did you calibrate?
There was a lot of lying down, I can tell you. We were there for like an hour, I'd say, all in.
it was a cheeky Sunday afternoon nap while you were there.
Oh yeah, yeah. You got to be trying each side of, like, trying, you know, each orientation. But then also, you do get to select, you know, okay, my side should be this and like firm, or that side should be medium or whatever. So we had to sort all that out, obviously. But look, it has massive potential. It could be the thing that makes my 2024, I think, low-key, massive, massive potential. It just hasn't arrived yet. When it arrives, I will be sure to give a detailed review, and I mean a proper usage of the star rating system. It won't be just a 1-star or a 5-star. We'll actually give it its proper score. So look forward to that. That'll be an exciting, exciting time.
Much appreciated. And well, I was thinking about this as we were talking, as a VTP, as a very tall person.
Oh, yeah.
Beds must not be the easiest thing for you.
210 centimeters is not the default, I can tell you.
Right.
And they're quite open about it. They're like, that's going to add on quite a lot of cash to the price just because you want 210 rather than 200. 200 is like the going length. But I have lived 33 years in beds where my feet go off the end. And I just kind of thought, you know what, if not for this, why do I work? Like, why do I earn a salary if not to give myself a bed that lets my feet be in it, you know? It really is that simple. Like, you got to look out for you sometimes. You got to treat yourself with a bit of respect, you know? And
I think so, which you didn't do for 33 years.
Exactly. Yeah. Life's too short to have your feet sticking out the end of a bed, you know? That is words to live by.
You never... one evening rolling around unable to sleep at 3 a.m. just said, why can I not have mattress under my feet? Why do I need to curl up into a ball every night to make use of this mattress?
It's a joke. And you know what? It's nothing new. The world is heightist. The world discriminates against tall people. Now, you could also argue it discriminates against small people too. much worse. That is also a valid argument. But I'm going to die on this hill, which is that tall people are given terrible, terrible treatment in very specific circumstances. This being one, planes being another, roller coasters sometimes being one.
Right.
Many tribulations and trials I've had to go through, I can tell you. Being tall, not all it's cracked to be.
The short end of the bed, some might even say.
You might say that, and you'd be absolutely correct for saying it. I think you're living the dream being within that strike zone of what would be called average to above average height. I'd say you're above average, right? Like,
It depends on the country, I guess.
Exactly. In a global sense, you're well above average, but in Denmark, I would say you're in the average, right? Like, strike zone.
Yeah, probably. Maybe slightly under it, but it's weird with these average height things. Actually, I wanted to run this by you because when we're in Denmark, nobody comments about how tall Leo, our son, is, right?
Mm-hmm.
The moment we're in Italy, everyone, without even knowing that he's 6 months old, because I would think calibrate height to age, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone is like, oh, here's the giant. Oh, this one's going to end up being really tall and everything. And I'm just like, huh? How are they getting this? And I'm just like asking, you know, my mother, etc. Are Italian babies just miniature until they're 3 years old or what? Like, it makes no sense to me.
But doesn't that make sense? Because Italians are on average shorter, right? And Southern Europeans in general they do end up being shorter on average.
But,
is that right?
But we're probably talking adults, and it's probably like the average difference, what, maybe like 3 centimeters on that average height?
It's actually a great question. Like, does it carry all the way to babyism to babyhood when like can is an Italian person who's used to seeing Italian babies already just like it's like triggering them to see a half Danish baby because they're like, huh, that's a bit bigger than normal, you know, like, yeah. Are they actually catching that, or
it must be,
yeah, and therefore measurably, like, what are we talking, are they just like a few centimeters smaller? I don't know. It's a great question. I actually hadn't picked up that your baby is above average baby size. But then again, why would I ever know that? My level of interaction with babies is essentially zero. So,
well, and you're a VTP, right? So your perspective on it is always going to be different from the average height person.
Exactly. Everyone is small to me, unfortunately. So, yeah, including your son.
Including my son. Very small indeed. Neil, we're going to take a quick break.
We are.
And we're going to come back with our closing segment for this episode. Listeners, welcome back to the Lost in Postulation podcast. Final segment here of episode 51. Neil, I want to end the show on this. I need your advice. I'm going to take you behind the curtain of the parent corner here.
Ooh, okay. Now, you're aware that I'm not a parent, just to be clear.
I'm very aware. That's why I need your opinion. Discussions in our house about something that, you know a lot about as a connoisseur of the music scene.
Oh, here we go. Yeah.
The music scene relative to parenting, Neil. My wife, Maria, who you know, has been tapping back into her back catalog of Danish children's music and playing that for her son. I have no problem with where the music comes from, whatever. Okay. I'm very open-minded.
Uh-huh.
The music sucks. It's annoying.
Yep.
It makes my ears bleed.
Yep.
And I say, hey, can't we just do normal music? So what I do is, honestly, I play for him whatever is kind of on my playlist, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at this age, keep in mind, he's a 6-month-old, right? My theory is, and we have a relatively calm baby, so it's not like we need to be putting music on so he doesn't cry or whatever, mm-hmm. but, you know, just to sometimes have some sound on in the background, now he's starting to interact with things.
Mm.
My theory is, as long as it's a sound with musical notes or whatever, it doesn't matter if it's specifically made for children, at least at this age that he's at. He's going to vibe out to it or not, regardless. It's not about what's coming out in terms of the music being for kids or not.
You know,
tell me what you think.
I actually, you're going to be shocked here. I disagree with you on this.
With me?
Yeah,
no.
Yeah. I actually...
I'm cutting this from the episode.
I know. So. And look, I take this with the largest pinch of salt you could imagine because I know nothing about this. But only to say, let's compare a couple of concepts here and see what you think of this. when a bird, you're going to be like, where am I going with this? When a bird gives birth to a clutch of babies, it will, in the early stages of life, such as a pigeon, it will digest food itself and then regurgitate it into the mouth of its baby chicks. And they do that because the baby chick just isn't ready to chew food itself because it's you know, teeth aren't developed enough. So the parent has to kind of simplify and adjust the world suit the baby a little bit, right? Similarly, when a child is like 7, 8, 9, 10, their taste buds are actually very, very, this is kind of a common knowledge, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, but their taste buds are way more sensitive than ours, to the point where if you bring them to a fine dining restaurant, they'll actually hate it in many cases because they're like, it's too intense. Like, if you give them like a sharp vinaigrette or something, they'll be like terrible, whereas we'd enjoy it because we're kind of more, our taste buds are less sensitive.
Hence kids' menus, I guess.
Hence kids' menus, exactly. Now, that gets us to kids' music, because kids' music is, to us, offensively horrible, right? Baby Shark is honestly a torture method in certain parts of the world. That is fair. However, I wonder if the simplicity of kids' music is what allows them to enjoy it more than we do, you know? And the evidence is there for all to see, because how many views does Baby Shark have on YouTube? It is the most viewed video in the world with hundreds of billions of views, right? Could it be that the simplicity of the kids' music, the Danish kids' music, is what he's vibing to most?
It could be, but he cracked a few laughs while I played him, you know, Hurricane by Bob Dylan and whatnot. I played him a bunch of stuff, right?
Okay.
And, but he does seem to vibe out a little more to the kids' music. I'm wondering if that's the tune of it, or if that's the fact that it's, like, what I doubt, Neil, what I'm getting at is that these people, these composers making kids' music are making it in a scientific way it works better with kids' ears.
I think you're right. That there is potentially a big scam here, like kids' books as well, where like someone can say, oh, I'm an author. And then you find out, hold on, what kind of author are you? I write kids' books. And it's like, Sammy the Snake goes to the zoo. And it's just like, very, you know, like, that's not an author, sorry. And they're going to come for me now, the kids' authors. But anyway, I'll take that back.
Dr. Seuss.
Dr. Seuss, sorry, hold on. Peace. Dr. Seuss gets a pass because his books are something. They're special. Like, they are kind of out on their own. Just from a rhyming...
He taught kids phonics, right? Yeah.
Like, yeah, from a rhyming scheme and like... a meter and rhythm perspective, Dr. Seuss is actually pretty cool. There's a guy on Instagram who raps the Dr. Seuss books, and it actually is fire.
Oh, beautiful.
But I'll send you that later. But I think composers of kids' music at least are aware of like the level of pattern recognition that a child is capable of, and then writing music that doesn't exceed that level of pattern, right? Like a jazz aficionado will notice a 2-5-1 turnaround and like... a Dorian scale jazz solo, they'll be like, aha, nice, that's a nice melodic use of that. But that's only because they've trained the pattern recognition over the years to like appreciate that. Whereas a baby needs to hear Baby Shark, do 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 do, Baby Shark, and like that's it. Just do that 200 times and the baby's like, amazing, you've nailed it, you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think there's something to it, but it's a great question.
Well, there you go. And that's why it's great to have you on this podcast, as someone that keeps their foot firmly jammed in the door that separates us mere mortals from the music industry.
I don't know if you get like some kind of sick kick out of saying that exact phrase, but like, it's great that you do.
Out of remembering it, because every time I'm like, oh, where's it going to go wrong? Which word am I going to forget? And then I think you smashed it though.
I don't think you've ever missed it really. Like you pretty much get it word for word.
I did create it, so
exactly.
You'd hope.
But it's like, what is that quote of like, stop trying to make fetch happen? Yeah, from Mean Girls. You know, it's like,
yeah,
it isn't okay. Maybe it is catching on. The listeners might be loving that phrase every time they hear it. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see. We'll have to let them write in.
We'll have to let them write in. Listeners, please do lostinpostulation@gmail.com or our Instagram, lostinpostulation. You can follow Neil on his private X while he's shredding the slopes and bringing on a climate apocalypse.
You can even find me on Strava. As I said, I'm taking over Strava. I'm the new Russ Cook, so do give me a follow. It's going to be very exciting.
Would you do the same? Would you run the length of Africa, or would you want to do a different continent at this stage?
Well, I have to one up him now, because like I would have to go west to east across Asia, I guess. Like that's right. the only option left.
Yeah, that would beat it, definitely. Well, because, I mean, North America has been done by Forrest Gump, your favorite film
of
all time.
My favorite documentary I've ever seen. Yeah, yeah. Amazing.
And fun fact, Tom Hanks's brother stands in for him during the scenes of running some point.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm on the record.
The documentary.
I'm on the record of my disdain for that film in general, but maybe...
Episode one of Lost in Postulation, you called it.
Wasted no time in ruffling more feathers, but maybe it's time to go back to it because it's been about 10 years and maybe I've grown as a person. Maybe I'll actually appreciate it more or maybe I'll hate it more. Who knows? We'll have to find out.
Believe you described it as indulgent. Great soundtrack, though.
I think I can agree on that, but I do still think it's indulgent. That's for sure.
Now, Neil, speaking of indulgence, do you want to leave the audience with a parting shot?
I would like to extend a half apology for the delay. We've actually been, you know, busy, as you can hear from the start of this episode. We've been doing stuff. We've been living our lives. Sorry, listeners. We're back in the game. We are we're back postulating, podcasting more fervently, more dedicated than ever. And thank you for your patience while we came back to podcasting. So that was all I was going to say.
Yeah, listeners. Well, just when you think they might, the postulations keep going. They never stop. Episode 51, we're entering a new era as we work our way towards the century mark here. And it wouldn't be possible without you guys. So please, if you can, take a chance to give a rating and review. It really helps to grow the podcast. Share this podcast with one, two, maybe even three friends.
Make your own postulator. Give it. It's magic. It really is. Like, you wouldn't believe the effects, the fan mail we get from people saying how we've changed their lives now that they're postulating. It's just, it's really emotional and it's moving. It's what keeps me doing it. And we just want to see more.
We just want to see more. And if anybody out there, that's my parting shot. If anybody out there listening to the podcast works in the bed industry, we want to hear from you. We want you on here to rebut Neil Fitzpatrick's postulations.
Exactly. I want to learn more about beds. Bring it on.
On that bed bombshell, listeners, so long. We'll talk to you on the next episode of the Lost in Postulation podcast. Au revoir.